Hey, you guys. Tomes of Terror time, and you know what that means? It's time for another horror book review. Now, I have to admit that as far as horror subgenres go, demonic possession stories aren't usually my favorite thing. Usually you guys know I'm more of like a haunted house girl, which I guess this kind of is too, but I'm not hugely into demon possession. I'm not averse to them, but it's not usually my favorite genre. But for some reason, while I was kind of scrolling through my Kindle recommendations, Nick Roberts' 2022 novel, The Exorcist's House, kind of popped out at me. I'm not really sure why exactly. I don't know if I just liked the sound of the name or if it's just kind of like, because the cover is nice, but it's not like all that striking or anything. So I was like, oh, what the hell? It was free to read with Kindle Unlimited, so I said I'll give it a whirl. So Nick Roberts is actually a West Virginia-based author who actually won the Debut Novel of the Year award back in 2021 for his first novel, which was called Anathema. So The Exorcist House is actually his second book, and as far as I know, he's working on his third one now. I think he teaches as well. And I will say right out of the gate that even though The Exorcist House isn't the most original thing ever, like I said, what is? It was still a hell of a lot of fun. I had a good time with it. And I definitely recommend it if you're into just real classic exorcism tropes. Also has some nods to Rosemary's Baby in there, which I actually like really appreciated. So the novel is set in the author's home state, West Virginia, in the 1990s. And it starts out with kind of like a brief prologue, which takes place in the spring. I believe it's March 1993. There's an old man named Merle Blatty, and he's kind of just sitting on a rock on his land, having a smoke, and talking to his faithful bloodhound, Buck. Now, from the tone of his thoughts and the stuff that he's saying to the dog, we're led to believe that he's kind of resigned to whatever his fate is going to be, and he's ready to go back into his farmhouse and deal with whatever the fuck is going on in there. So, because the name of the book is The Exorcist's House, you're led to assume that there's some demonic shenanigans occurring inside the house, and that the old man has kind of come to terms with the fact that he's not being going to be able to survive the upcoming battle. He even briefly considers, and this almost made me panic for a second, because you guys know how I do. He even briefly considers like killing the dog, like as a mercy killing, and I was like, no, please don't do that. But thankfully, he decides, oh, he's gonna let the good boy go and fend for himself in the surrounding woods after whatever's going to happen, ends up going down. So I will say just right from the jump, thank you, thank you, thank you, Nick Roberts, for not killing the dog. Jesus Christ. I'm getting really, really bummed out by all of these horror novels bumping off the cute pets. Like I said, kill all the people you want. I don't give a shit, but leave the goddamn animals alone. So it was actually kind of nice to read a book where the dog not only, spoiler alert, survives, but again, spoiler alert, helps, is kind of in there helping to fend off the evil at the end. And we do love a hero animal in stories. So anyway, after Merle is evidently dispatched by this demon that he's fighting, we jump ahead a little more than a year to April of 1994. And then we start to follow our main protagonists, who are the Hill family. So you have Dad, Daniel, and he's a psychologist, like with his own practice. And then the mom, Nora, I think she's like a high school teacher, and she's also 6 months pregnant at the beginning. And the couple also have a 16-year-old daughter named Alice. Now, Daniel has gotten this wild idea into his head for whatever reason that he's going to buy a farm in rural West Virginia for cheap. Like, he just found one that was cheap, and we'll know why in a minute. He's going to fix it up and then sell it for profit. So, essentially, flip it is what he was going to do. Now, Nora is kind of less enthused about this idea, but she decides she's going to go along with it anyway. Partly because, or maybe even mostly because, she actually feels really guilty because she had sort of like a fling, one night stand type of situation with a coworker. I think it was like actually her boss or like the principal of her school or something like that. And she never told Daniel about it, so she feels really bad. So she's just kind of like, okay, well, I'm just going to go along with whatever he says because I feel really guilty. guilty. So that's why. So I guess the family is going to live in the farmhouse, like, for a little while, like, over the summer or whatever, at least until all the renovations are complete. And then after they sell it, they're going to move back to the city and hopefully have, like, a bunch more money in their bank account. Because I think, like, the way that it was described, like, I guess this farm is, like, an hour away from where they used to live. And, like, Daniel is still going to be working. But Nora is out for the summer because she's a teacher. And then, like, by the time the new school year starts, she'll be on maternity leave anyway. So they're kind of figuring he's just going to commute and she's just going to be on maternity leave. So they're going to be like an hour away from where their house was before. Now, naturally, it will surprise no one that the farmhouse and the land surrounding it that they have purchased belonged to Merle Blatty. And the reason that it was so reasonably priced was because the house was actually partially damaged by a little bit of a weird fire, very vaguely unnatural fire, that occurred on the night that Merle was killed. So actually only the second floor was affected. I don't know if it burned off the whole second floor, but it was just kind of like one room on the second floor, like where the demonic shit took place. So Daniel actually like hires a crew to come in and do a bunch of work on the house like before they get there. So by the time the Hill family arrives, a lot of the renovation work has been done, at least the major stuff, and the place looks fantastic. There's just like some little stuff to do, like out in the yard, like, you know, building a fence and crap like that. But the foreman of the construction crew sees something like on their last day, like he sees something peeking out at him from the basement. Something that looks a little, like I said, a little demonic, and a few days later seemingly commits suicide in a really, really gruesome way. Now, the Hills find out about this like a day or two after it happens, and they're like bummed out, but they're not overly concerned because the guy actually died at a motel in town. Like, it's not like he killed himself like in the house or anything like that that they're going to be living in. One thing that does sort of bother them, though, is that somebody has been inside the house, like, in the last few days, because Daniel has been up there and has been inside the house, like, checking out all the work and stuff, and then, like, a few days later, they moved all their stuff in, and he's like, hey, it wasn't like this before, but when they come in there, he's like, somebody's been in here, like, broke in here and nailed the door to the basement shut, like, put in all the nails, like, in the shape of a cross. So not too long after the Hill family moves in, they discover that their house, of course, used to belong to Merle Blatty, who they find out wasn't actually sanctioned by the church, like he wasn't a priest or anything like that, but he was something of a quote-unquote backwoods exorcist who had actually trained with some sympathetic like clergymen, like some priests that were actually sanctioned by the church, and he would occasionally like help out in possession cases across the country, sometimes like where the official church didn't want to get involved or they'd already been in there and they thought nothing was going on, and like so he would just go and help people like around the country and had been doing it for several years, like I think 20 years he'd been doing it. Yeah, because I think he started out in 1973, so he'd been doing it for 20 years. So a lot of the information that we learn about Merle actually comes from a kind of a younger man, I think he's 17 or 18 or something like that, whose name is Luke, and he lives with his dad nearby, and he used to do kind of handyman stuff and yard work, like he would mow Merle's lawn and shit like that, you know, around the farm when Merle was alive. So Luke comes there and said, hey, you know, Merle used to like pay me to do all this work around the farm, and I can do that for you still. If you want, I can fix your fence, I can mow your lawn, I can do all this other kind of stuff. So the Hills are like, yeah, great, you know, that'd be awesome, because like I said, you know, Daniel's got to work and Nora's, you know, real pregnant, so they need somebody to kind of like fix some stuff up. So they're very happy to, and he seems like a really nice kid and everything, and the daughter Alice is like really, really smitten with him. They seem like smitten with each other and kind of start having like a little bit of a, not, I wouldn't call it a romance necessarily, but a little pre-romance, I guess. It doesn't really get that far, but yeah. Oh, and also Merle's old dog Buck, who like I said, he let him loose in the woods like after he went off to fight the demon and got killed, so he's been living in the woods this whole time, he actually returns and gets adopted into the family, so that's nice. Like I said, I was worried about what was gonna happen to the dog, but it's fine, he survives. Very slowly though, as usually happens in stories like this, weird shit starts to happen. Most of the stuff at first kind of revolves around the door to the basement kind of like coming open by itself, various family members seemingly, I don't even know if I'd want to call it sleepwalking, but sometimes they like end up down there and kind of seeing horrible things that are specifically tailored to them, like usually like what their guilt is or what, like for example, like Nora sees the guy she slept with and stuff like that. They attribute these events to kind of like stress dreams at first, because, you know, they've been going through a lot. But then they also start to notice like some other weird shit. Like, they're also having instances of like missing time. Like, some of them will, you know, it's like they go to the kitchen or they go and do something, and then like several hours pass by, but to them it only seemed like a couple minutes. And then they come back out and they're like, where the fuck have you been? And they're like, what are you talking about? I just went in there like 5 minutes ago. And they're like, dude, it's been like 3 hours. What the fuck? So there's like all this missing time type shit going on too. So then finally, Daniel, he gets very curious about this little secret room, like it's kind of like the Amityville Horror a little bit, that he discovers in the basement that ends up containing this real, real deep well that somebody has hung crucifixes and shit over and like put kind of a cover over it with a cross and all this other kind of stuff. Now, so he goes down there one night to like to see what this is, because he finds like a bunch of trunks and everything like that that presumably like belong to Merle and his late wife. It's like a bunch of their clothes and stuff. But when he's down there this one particular night when he can't sleep, he actually is confronted with the quite terrifying looking spirit of Merle Blatty himself, who appears as like a charred corpse, because that's how he died. Like, he burned up like that. Like, he's a nice ghost and everything, but he can't help like the way he looks, and he just keeps getting burned like over and over, and that's what he looks like. He looks all melted and shit. So he shows up and he basically tells Daniel, you have to read through all of the journals that I left behind like in this other trunk that's like in this secret room with me, and you have to figure out how to seal this well that's in the basement, because of course it is a gateway to hell. So Daniel ends up finding the old man's journals and a bunch of videotapes of all his previous exorcisms, like over the past however many years. I think he started videotaping them in the 80s. And Daniel starts to become like obsessed with going through them. Meanwhile, the demon from the well is kind of fucking with everybody's minds, making them see like really, really horrible shit, you know, stuff that isn't there, like making them see family members doing stuff that they're not doing and all this other kind of stuff. Apparently, it seems like just trying to sow chaos and like trying to turn them against one another, things like that. So this kind of all keeps going until it comes to a head, and then that leads up to this big kind of classic exorcism battle royale between the family and then this priest that they summon who had actually known Merle and like trained him a long time ago. And so they're kind of fighting this demon that's inhabiting this well in the basement. And the whole scene, like at the end, it's very, very, very classic. Like I said, exorcism stuff. There's levitations and fire and like people with like fire in their eyes, fucked up visions and gloppy black substances driven from the ceiling, all that kind of crazy shit. So as I said, this was actually like a pretty fun read and, you know, kept me interested, very compelling, like all the way up until the very end. I had a couple like very minor nitpicks, really. One thing, and I think I brought this up on a review of another book, although I can't remember what it was, but every now and then, like the author would occasionally switch points of view from character to character, like within a single scene. And I'm always like a little bit confused when that happens, because I'm always like, and I know this isn't a hard and fast rule, but I was always like more of an advocate of, if you're gonna switch the POV like of a character, like if you're inside this character's head and then you want to go into another character's head, then I would usually like change a section, like start a new section, just to keep it like so it's not confused and you're not like hopping from brain to brain like in one scene. I just find that kind of jarring and a little bit confusing. It didn't happen a lot in the book, but it did happen a couple times and it sort of like stuck out to me. Like I said, not a huge deal, but that was just like a minor nitpick that I had. So there's that. Also, I have to say, at first when I was reading like the big end, like the big, you know, battle royale, like I said, at the end, like the big final confrontation between the family and the demon, I thought it was a little bit, I don't know if I want to say abrupt, but it seemed like it could have gone on a little bit longer, or it was maybe like too easy or something like that. But after I kept reading, and then there's like, because after the big exorcism battle, there's like a coda that kind of says what happened in the aftermath. And after I read all of that, that kind of, and I'm not going to spoil it, but that kind of like introduced a new complication into the story, which I actually really liked. So then I kind of retroactively was like, I didn't mind the confrontation being kind of short. It's not that short, but I thought it was just like a little bit shorter than maybe it should have been. But after I read to the end, I was just kind of like, oh, okay. I kind of felt like I knew why he maybe did that at that point. So it didn't like bother me as much. So all in all, I would definitely recommend this if you're a fan of like movies like The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby or Amityville Horror, which I mentioned before. It's a very, very classic demon possession style narrative, but it has kind of enough unique character to make it its own thing and make it worthwhile. And it comes across as like real gruesome, like a bunch of real gory shit happens in it. And it's very, very cinematic, like the way that it's written. So that was definitely like points in its favor. You know, it moved along at a good pace and it introduced, I think my favorite concept about it was the demon being able to like show you really realistic hallucinations. So you were never really sure if what the protagonists were seeing was what was really going on, because they would each see their own thing, like, and it was, like I said, tailored specifically to them, like, because the demon knew what would bother them the most, and so it would show them. Then, like, other people would be like, what the fuck are you looking at? I don't see anything. So it was that kind of thing. So I really liked that there was that kind of ambiguity about what you were seeing and, like, whether it was real or not. So I thought that was, like, kind of cool, and I think that was probably, like, my best part of the story. And honestly, I kind of feel like this would be a really good one, you know, now that it's September at last, so we're coming up into fall and we're coming up into Halloween and everything like that. And this seemed to me, even though it's actually set in the spring and summer, it actually comes across to me as like just kind of like a real good like Halloween type of story, just because it's so classic and it's so exorcist-y. And you know, so if you like that kind of thing, then you will probably really like this a lot. As I said, if you have Kindle Unlimited, you can read it on there for free, or of course you can of course get the paperback if you want to do that. So that will do it for this Tomes of Terror, and I will see you guys again on the next one. Bye.